Your Bibles to 1 Kings chapter 12. We're going to spend most of our time in this particular section of the Bible. The divided kingdom is not an easy thing to really commit to memory. Most good Bible students can go through the Genesis. They can go through the Exodus and go through the Judges. The United Kingdom comes along. There's Saul, there's David, there's Solomon. We can get through that with pretty good recollection. And then the divided kingdom comes. And you got 20-something kings to the north, 20-something kings to the south. Many of their names starts with a J. The ones that doesn't start with a J seems to start with an A. And before you know it, you just got this mix-up. I want to spend a little bit of time with one of those particular kings today. But let's just remind ourselves of how all this came to be. God came to Jeroboam through a prophet and told him, I'm going to divide the nations up. I'm going to give you 10 of the tribes. And I will bless you in the very same way I blessed David. I'm going to make a monarchy out of you. Your seed will continue to reign. But Jeroboam didn't stay faithful. And it happened almost in the blink of an eye. As he's anointed king, and all of a sudden the calendar begins to roll and a feast day rolls around. And he and Jeroboam begins to reckon within himself, if my people realize they're going to have to go to Jerusalem all these different times, they're going to get tired of that, and they'll just move closer down there. They'll leave here, and they'll go there out of convenience sake. Don't sometimes we do things out of convenience? We want to be closer to certain places or things, or they're going to move. I'm going to lose them. My kingdom's going to start shrinking. So he came up with the conclusion. Pick up with me in verse 27. If the people go to sacrifice at the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, the heart of the people will turn against their Lord. Even Rehoboam, king of Judah, they will kill me, and they will go to Rehoboam, king of Judah. My kingdom won't last as long as Jerusalem is a part of their life. Verse 28. Therefore the king took counsel. And I want you to look at all the things that he began to do. He made 2 cows of gold, and he said to them, it's too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Behold the gods of Israel, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. And he set one up in Bethel, and he set one up in Dan. So if you can kind of picture a map in your mind, picture here's Dan here to the north, Bethel down on the south. So he's put one on the northern and southern borders. It's going to be close to everybody in Israel. One of those will. And he's changed the place of worship. You don't got to go to Jerusalem. If you live close to Dan, go there. If you live close to Bethel, don't bypass Bethel. You're going to have to walk past Bethel to even get there. Just stop there. So much easier. He changes the place of worship. Verse 30. And this became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one, even to Dan. And he made a house of high places. And he made priests from among all the people, which were not the sons of Levi. You don't got to be a Levite anymore. In our nation, you got somebody from Gad, you want to be a priest? Have at it. Somebody from Ephraim, congratulations. Somebody from Manasseh, jump on in, the water's fine. He took priests from all the tribes, changed the place of worship. He has changed the priesthood who offers up the sacrifices of that worship. Verse 32, Jeroboam ordained a feast in the 8th month, 15th day, like the feast in Judah. It's like it, but there are some changes. First of all, the place is different. The priesthood is different. Did you catch in verse 32? The month is different. The day is different. He's talking about the Day of Atonement here, which was 7th month, 14th day. They changed to the 8th. And the fifth, he changed it all. Now, if you're wondering where this came about, well, there's an answer for that too. Verse 33. Jeroboam offered up on the altar, which he had made in Bethel, the 15th day of the 8th month, the month he devised from his own heart. He just came up with it himself. He invented all this. He came up with this all on his own. And what it does is it starts this long, constant trend that rolls through Israel throughout the history of it. There was no good kings that came out of Israel. They all followed what would later on become known as the sins of Jeroboam, referring to these things right here. And that's how history went for a while, until it got even worse. And that was when Ahab and Jezebel took over. And they were not followers of the sins of Jeroboam, because they brought a false god into it. Not Jeroboam has set up idols. Ahab and Jezebel brought in a false god. They brought in Baal and Ashtaroth, and they were militant supporters of that, and they began to kill the prophets of God. God battles that. He rises up a prophet named Elijah that you'll remember, and Elijah began to fight that, and he halted this moment for a little bit. There's the incredible event on Mount Carmel where God showed so clearly that there was no strength to Baal, but that didn't make much change at all. And the very next day, there's a bounty put on his head, and Elijah runs off into the wilderness. And you know what happened there? Lord, there's nobody but me. It doesn't seem to be doing any good. I'm all that's... Just take me. I'm done. And God began to reassure him. We're not going to look at all that. We're just trying to get our mind and remember these events of the divided kingdom era. But one of the things that God told him is in chapter 19. 1 Kings chapter 19. As Elijah is in this state of depression, he's in this funk. I'd just as soon not live anymore. Just take me on, Lord. And God basically roused him up. He said, you're not alone. There are people here. You don't know about them, but they're there. But before he said that, he basically gave Elijah some advice me and you can probably do really good to digest. He's basically going to shake him and said, Elijah, I've got a job for you. There is work for you to be doing. Get out of the desert. Stop the moaning. Stop the groaning. I have a job for you. And in verse 15, he begins to tell him what that job is. The Lord said to him, go and return to the wilderness of Damascus. And there you will come and you will anoint Hazael to be king of Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you will anoint the king over Israel. And that's who I want to talk about today. Elijah, ready to die. There's no good here. There's no use to this. This is a wasted movement. And God says, I got to work for you. I've got a job for you. You're going to go and you're going to anoint Jehu for me. I am picking him. I am choosing him. He's going to be the king of Israel. And then I'm going to have a job for him as well. And so there's the interesting thing. Let's look at Jehu, because he, as we just saw, he's handpicked by God. God comes to Elijah and said, you go get this man and you anoint this man. And so let's talk about him just a little bit. Turn to 2 Kings chapter 9. That's when it takes place. God sends Elijah on his way, gives him this work, and then as time passes, now we come to the time when it occurs. Elisha now, after that incredible event with the whirlwind and the chariots of fire and so on, Elisha now, God's prophet. And in 2 Kings chapter 9, God sends him to, and tells him what he's going to do. He comes to the house in verse 6. And Elisha, rose up and went into the house. He poured oil on his head, talking about Jehu. He poured oil on his head. And he said to him, thus says the Lord God of Israel, I have anointed you king over the people of the Lord, even over Israel. You will smite the house of Ahab, your master, that I may avenge the blood of my servants, the prophets, and the blood of all the servants of the Lord, and the hand of Jezebel. For the whole house of Ahab shall perish. I will cut off Ahab and all the male children of him that is shut up and left in Israel. Elisha comes. If God has anointed you, God has a work for you, And basically, just to paraphrase what we just saw there, he has given Jehu the work of reshaping the landscape of Israel. You're going to do this. And you're going to do that. And when it's over with, Ahab and Jezebel, there will be nothing left. He's given him a commission. And the commission is, remove that family from the face of the earth. Let's look at how that all took place. Let's look at the chronology of it. He immediately rises up and begins to do that. He goes on a scavenger hunt. And in verse 24... And again, the divided kingdom is confusing because of all the names. So I'm going to remind us of who these people are. We've all studied it, but the names may be slipping on us. In verse 24, he has chased down a man named Joram, which is Ahab's son and the one who ascended to the throne by birth. You know how monarchies work. Ahab dies, Joram rises up to king. But remember, Jehu's been anointed by God to remove all of that. So in verse 24... Jehu drew a bow with all his strength, and he smote Jehoram between the arms, and an arrow went out of his heart, and he sunk down in his chariot. Ahab's son, the successor by birth, dead. And by the way, just a little bit of trivia, that happened in Naboth's vineyard. Does that strike a bell? Remember how Ahab desired it and hid this whore? Jezebel has a man murdered, a good man murdered, just for possession. Ahab's son dies in that very field. In verse 27, when Ahaziah, king of Judah, saw this. Now hang on just a second. I thought Jehu was re-landscaping Israel. But here's what happened in the meantime. Jezebel and Ahab's children have matriculated down into the southern kingdom. Israel and Judah, the kingship, they have intermarried. And now Ahab has children. He has family members. That's a law that is now a part of the royal line in Judah as well. Ahaziah is Ahab's grandson. It's the son of Ahab's daughter. And now he's the king of Judah. Verse 27. Ahaziah, the king of Judah, saw this. He fled by the way of the garden house. When he sees what Jehu is up to, he tries to take off. Jehu followed after him and said, "Smite him in the chariot." And they did so. And so, almost in the blink of an eye, king of Israel, Ahab's son, dead. King of Judah, Ahab's grandson, dead. Verse 33. If you keep on reading down in about verse 30 or so, word spreads to Jezebel what's going on. She's lost a son and a grandson that day as well. And she knows there is a conspiracy. She knows there is now a coup going on. And now she's worried. Jehu rolls into town, goes up into the palace. And in verse 33, he said to a couple of men that were there in that area, he said, "Throw her down." So here she is up in these upper balcony areas. They took her, verse 33, they threw her down, some of her blood sprinkled on the wall and on the horses. She lands, after they threw her, she lands with such force as she hits, blood splattering everywhere. Joram dead. Ahaziah dead. Jezebel dead. Look in chapter 10. The commission given to Jehu keeps going. Chapter 10. Look in verse 11. And we're just getting the end of this. We're just looking at the synopsis of it instead of looking through the specifics. In verse 11, so Jehu slew all that remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, all his great men, all of his friends, all of his priests, until there was none left. He cleans house. And all of this, back up into verse 10, he says, so that you will know, there will not fall to the earth anything that the Lord says, which the Lord said concerning the house of Ahab. And the Lord has done what he had spoke by his servant Elijah. All this stuff happened just as God told Elijah it was going to happen. And now one last thing. What's left are all those prophets of Baal. And so there's a long event that's chronicled for us where Jehu goes into town and the scene is all of the priests of Baal. He gets them into a room together and we're going to have a shindig like never before. I want all the prophets of Baal to get in there. And so they go in expecting this incredible service, this incredible sacrifice. In verse 23 of chapter 10, Jehu went in, and Jehonadab the son of Rechab, into the house of Baal. And he said to the worshippers of Baal, "Search and look, that there be none here with you who are servants of the Lord, and servants of Baal only." So he goes in, he says, "Okay, I want y'all to take a look. I don't want anybody from Jehovah in here. Y'all just take a look." And so they start checking, they start counting, they start looking around. No, there's nobody in here but us. And then, once that's done, drop down to verse 25. "It came to pass, as soon as he had made an end of the offering, the burnt offering, Jehu said to the guard and to the captains, 'Go in, slay them, let none come out.' They smote them with the edge of the sword, and the guard and the captains cast them out. They went to the city, the house of Baal. They brought forth the images from the house and they burned them. They broke down the images of Baal. They broke down the house of Baal and they made it into," the old King James says, "into a draught unto this day." Me and you would call that a public restroom. That's not the word. They changed the wording of that. But what they did was just to show the despicableness of it. They turned those places of the where the idols were and where the house of worship was and that where the sacrifices to Baal had been made. They turned it into what me and you would call a public restroom. And at the time of the kings, he says, unto this day. They could have gone there that very day and they knew exactly what he was talking about. Now, when you look through this event, and I failed to take us through killing Jehoram and Ahaziah and Jezebel, the brothers, the friends, the prophets. I know in a room this big, there are some people in here who just love Hallmark movies. Jehu's not a Hallmark movie. Jehu is the kind of movie that when you get through with it, there's also some people in here who at the end of a movie expect about 5 explosions per minute, or they're not going to be very happy. That's the kind of story Jehu is. This is a bloodbath. From the time he is anointed until right here, there has been nothing but killing. Now the interesting thing is, we're about to get into the character study. This is not a character study. This is a man doing what God told him to do. Don't look at this as any differently than you would look. Don't look at the blood on Jehu's hands any differently than you do the blood of the judges. There were times when judges were risen up by God to destroy Midianites or Philistines or Ammonites, and they were doing a God-given work. Don't look at the blood on Jehu's hands any differently than you look at the blood on David's hands. David was a man of war. David was a man who was a man of death, and he stood up against vicious and ungodly people. Jehu is doing what he was told to do. But that is where the comparison ends. The difference in Jehu and David is not what they did. The difference in Jehu and David is the hearts from which they did it. David is who you all know and can quote, a man after God's own heart. I want you to mark your spot because we're coming right back to this. But I want you to turn to Hosea chapter 1. And if the minor prophets kind of give you some trouble, well, this is an easy one. Hosea is the first of the minor prophets. So just find David, just find Daniel and keep on turning pages. You remember Hosea? A prophet whom God used in a physical way to show how painful unfaithfulness can be. Israel unfaithful to God, and it hurt him. And so he puts a prophet right smack in the middle of them, whose wife publicly and consistently cheated on him with other men. She was unfaithful. The whole town knew about it. And here's Hosea representing God in how to be loving in such a situation. But as those children began to be born, and the inferences that every one of them born out of wedlock to other men, not Hosea, but to others. And in verse 4, as one of those children are born, the Lord said to him, talking about Hosea, "You call this son Jezreel. For yet in a little while, and I will avenge the bloodshed of Jezreel on the house of Jehu." And so what we have here, here's this little inference that, okay, Jehu obeyed the commands, but the spirit by which he obeyed those commands, not exactly positive. What we're dealing with probably is just a man that liked it, delighted in it. He's not killing those people because he was disgusted with idolatry. He's not going into these battles because he hates what they have said and done to God and his people. He just kind of likes it, evidently. And God, through Hosea, says there's going to come a time that there's going to be a reward for that. And so again, there is a difference between David and Jehu's heart. So now what we've got to do, now with that being done, go back to 2 Kings 10 and look at that heart in action. God has just anointed Jehu. Can you put yourself there? I want you to imagine all the people on earth at that time, and God comes to you and says, "I pick you." A little fired up about that? I would think all of us in this room would be fired up when God says, "I want you." God has done that to Jehu, and he has delivered him through all these battles, and it no more gets accomplished. We're back in 2 Kings chapter 10, look in verse 29. "However, from the sons of Jeroboam, the sons of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, Jehu did not depart from them." That is, the golden calves that was in Bethel and that was in Dan. Verse 31, "Jehu took no heed to walk in the law of the Lord God of Israel with all his heart. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam." He just goes right on back to mama. Jehu, when he is now king, all the threats are gone, all the enemy is destroyed. He is now reigning as ruler, God-anointed ruler. And he goes right back to sinful place, sinful priest, sinful months, sinful days, sinful everything. That's the difference in David and Jehu. This is not a heart of obedience. This is not a heart of appreciation. And the interesting thing is, that makes it even more sad, Jehu reigned for 28 years. And when you go back and look into the kings of Israel, that was a long reign. There were so many changing of monarchies and so many overthrows. There were kings that ruled less than weeks. And yet here's a man God just let reign. He let him reign and he let him reign. This reign extended out and he never submitted. So what we're going to do is look at this man as a character study, and what can me and you learn for ourselves. And the first one is, specifics matter. We got to understand that. Specifics matter. If we could go back in a time machine to the nation of Israel, outside of Ahab and Jezebel, mind you, but you go back to those other kings and you ask them while offering sacrifices at Bethel and while offering sacrifices at Dan, "What are you doing?" You know what they're going to say? "We're offering sacrifices to God." They didn't see it as offering sacrifices to a false god. They did not create some false god. They recognized Jehovah. What they did was they set up idols to represent him. But if you could go back in a time machine and ask him who they were worshiping, they would have said, "We're worshiping Jehovah." There are people all over this world today doing a lot of things in the name of religion. And if you ask them who it's toward, they're going to say it's toward the Creator. They're going to say it's toward the Father of Jesus. They're going to say it's to Jehovah God Almighty. But what we find out with Jehu, all the kings that went to Jeroboam's sins, what we find out is the specifics matter. Because to offer up a sacrifice in the name of Jehovah from the wrong place, wrong time, wrong this, wrong that, wrong... it matters. The questions that all probably have asked yourself, and you needed to ask themselves, at some point, as your faith became your own, when you moving away from mom and daddy to a conviction of your own, questions that have to be asked is, does this stuff really matter? You've got to decide that for yourself, or it doesn't mean anything. Does it really, are we not being nitpicky? Do instruments of music really matter? Does every first day of the week really matter? Aren't we nitpicking? And when you ask those questions, I hope the answers that you found yourself looking at was, well, it sure seemed to matter. The small things seemed to matter with Nadab and Abihu. Because fire was not fire. It mattered. Because they were condemned. When you look through Uzzah, is it really matter how we move the ark? Doesn't just getting it to Jerusalem, want that, as long as, doesn't the end justify the means? As long as we get it there, they seem to matter. Uzzah died on the spot. And we can look through countless examples. No, it's not being nitpicky. It's being reverent. It's being obedient. It's saying your way is the only way and I'll submit to that. And Jehu didn't do it. 1 Corinthians chapter 4. We're going to look at a quick New Testament example. What we're coming down to is ultimately is Jehu, like all the kings before him, Jehu stumbled at true loyalty. And me and you can be guilty of that too. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, this is speaking just a little bit out of its context. All these things, brethren, I have in a figure transferred to myself and to Apollos for your sakes, that you might learn in us not to think above that which is written. That none of you be puffed up for one against another. Again, this is talking about the people that was trying to elevate themselves above. But the point that I want to emphasize is, he says, me and you, by application, we need to learn not to think above that which is written. God has revealed Himself to us. And don't think above it. Don't try to think around it. Don't try to think of a better way. Don't think of a more improved way. Don't think above what is written. The specifics matter. That's what we see in Jehu. What we see in Jehu is the fleeting nature of success. Because again, if you could go back in a time zone, a time machine, and just start asking other world leaders, what do you think about Jehu? What do you think all those other world leaders in the surrounding neighborhoods would have thought? Here's exactly what they would have thought. That on a world level and on a national level, he has led the picture-perfect revolt. Picture-perfect overthrow. He got rid of everybody that would have been against him. That he has gotten rid of basically everyone that could take a claim on his throne. They would have looked at him as a number one of how to do it, if you're going to do it. Here's the thing. God's standard of achievement and God's standard of acceptability aren't always the same as the world standard. And me and you can get wrapped up in this too. What does this world call success? This world's going to call success titles and stuff and possessions and bank accounts, and popularity, and fame, and fortune, and the so-called good life. That's what this world calls success. That's what Hollywood calls it. It's what Wall Street calls it. It's what politics call it. It's what DC calls it. God has a completely different idea about that, and we see that in Jehu. So the character study for us, me and you, with an honest assessment, when we turn the binoculars on ourselves, what type of success are we really chasing after? Are we wanting success from the worldly standpoint? Are we wanting to seem successful from the neighborhood and from the city and from the community? Or are we wanting God's stamp of approval? Because Jehu seems to have everybody's stamp of approval in Israel except God Himself. And which one are we chasing after? An example of a character study of Jehu is the idea that close isn't enough. I saw in one commentary, it would have been funny if it wasn't so sad. There was one commentator who starts his expose on Jehu by saying, Jehu was nearly a good king. That would be funny if it wasn't exactly right. If it wasn't so consequential. He was almost a good king. Because he starts out doing all these things God tells him to do. When I was growing up, I have not heard this since I was a kid. Maybe it's still out there, I don't know. But when I was growing up, in our neighborhood growing up, kids would say, well, I almost got it, or we almost got it. And somebody would say, close only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades. I don't know if any of you else heard that when you were growing up. That was a well-used phrase when I was a kid. In horseshoes, you can win without ever even ringing the thing. Because close does count. And a grenade explode, you don't have to hit somebody in the nose with a grenade. Just get it close, it'll do its damage. But serving God, it's not about just how close can we get. It's how right, the right things in the right manner. John chapter 4, it's the Spirit, it's the truth, and one no more significant than the other, because to lose that one of them is to lose it all of it. And defeating enemies, because Jehu has defeated enemies, defeating enemies isn't enough without turning to God wholeheartedly. And so me and you can do all we want to do about exposing atheism or exposing Islam or Hindu or any other false teaching you want to put out there. But if our final steps never get around to obeying, what have we done? Interesting questions to ask. There's no answers to. But what do you think maybe held him back? What are some things we can look at that we might have some trouble with in a character study? Well, maybe what held Jehu back was maybe it was just family. My great-granddaddy worshipped at Dan and Bethel. My great-grandmother worked at Dan. You know, my mom and dad worshipped at Dan. That's just what we do. You know people like that. Maybe it was some tribal pride. And maybe what Jeroboam had said initially kind of took some root in it. I don't want my people going to Jerusalem. I don't want them leaving this nation. I want them staying here. We're going to do everything here. We don't need them. Maybe we can think like that. And again, we looked at Hosea chapter 1. All of this coming out of a heart that just seemed to never be in sync with God, even when he was technically doing what God wanted him to do. Can we be guilty of that? We'll do some things God told us because they fit with our nature. It's what we. There are some parts God told us that we really, really like. Tim mentioned that last week in one of his lessons. There are people maybe here who flat out don't like singing. Maybe you don't like your voice. God didn't tell you to sing if you liked your voice. God commanded you to sing and to edify and to admonish your brethren and to lift songs of praises to His name. Are we going to do the ones we like and ignore the things we don't? We'll obey as long as it fits with what we want. That maybe seems to be what Jehu is doing. We can be guilty of a lot of the very same things this man was guilty of. Let's get your songbooks out. Character studies. I love them. They're beneficial to us. And here's an example of one. Not a good man. But there are things we can see in his life that can hopefully help us. I want to take you back to a question I asked you earlier. You can go back in a time machine and all the people on the earth, God says, I pick you to do my work for me. That's what he did to Jehu. I want you to go do this for me. That's exactly what he's done for each and every one of us. Regardless of our weaknesses, regardless of our struggles, regardless of the rebelliousness we've had, the stubbornness we have, he sent his son to die for each of us so that we could do his works. We could do his labor in these earthly vineyards as long as we're here. Think about it. God looking down, make this personal. God looked down and said, I want you to work for me. I want you to do this for me. Do we appreciate that? First of all, do we appreciate to the point we've even accepted that invitation? And we are now working for him. We are his. If we are, how are we busy with the work? Or like Jehu, are we doing the things that kind of benefit us? We're doing the things we like,
but leaving a whole lot of other work undone. We have time to change. Let's do it while we stand and sing.